Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is a Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality we find below the surface.
Yes. This is episode 90. Crazy. 90. Isn't that amazing?
That is.
It's been so fun.
It has. Yes. I love it.
And today we're going to talk about a movie based on a very little known story in the Bible. That it's called Noah. Yes. By Darren Aronofsky and starring some other people.
Who is that guy?
Yeah, Russell Crowe.
Yeah.
Yep. Fresh from Les Mis, I believe. Didn't this come out after?
Again,
he
by
did.
The way.
He did, yeah.
Although they mercifully let him kind of whisper it. So.
Yes, and Jennifer Connelly, Ray Winstone, Anthony Hopkins, mm-hmm. Emma Watson, and Logan Lerman. Logan Lerman, my family knows as the kid from The Lightning Thief, Percy Jackson.
Oh.
Yeah.
Did he play Shem, the one with the beard and the Jesus hair, or was
no.
he Ham?
He was Ham. Oh. Yeah. So it was interesting from a history standpoint, I guess, to have Logan Lerman and Emma Watson in a scene together.
That's right.
Yeah, because of what they've been in the past. But I sure like Emma Watson. I've seen a few things, anyway, she's done since Potter, and I think she's going to have a very great career.
She was really great in this.
Yeah.
But, you know, everybody was great in this,
yeah,
I thought.
Yeah, I agree.
I have to say, I'm not a fan of Russell Crowe necessarily. I mean, just kind of like Marlon Brando, where I'd look at him and go, wow, what a great actor. He just doesn't appeal to me necessarily. But in this movie, I just thought, wow, I didn't realize he could do so much with just, you know, changing the anguished look in his eyes or whatever. And I've seen several people saying, yes, isn't Aronofsky a fantastic director to get that out of him? I don't know if that's, I haven't seen very many of his movies, so I don't know.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah, and this couldn't have been a very easy role to play. I mean, there was... I didn't think so anyway. When I look at it, you know, there's a lot of motivations and things that he goes through that are very difficult. And he sold it, though.
Yeah, this Noah is, as most people have probably heard who are interested in it at all and haven't seen it yet, is not, you know, the smiling, happy guy with the long beard and his arm around his little round Mrs. Noah as they stand there with giraffe heads coming out of the boat as they're going along.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a tortured, very realistic guy, I think, yeah. In a lot of ways.
Very intense, yeah.
And Aronofsky's known for his really intense stories that he seems to really like those, and I... therefore, have never seen one of his movies until now.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen a couple of them. Black Swan. And what was the other one? I don't have it in front of me. He did The Wrestler. I've never seen The Wrestler.
Yeah, and that's one I actually would be interested in seeing sometime.
Yeah.
I'd have to be forced, but...
Yeah. So, you know, I've read several things about this movie. And though I haven't backed this up, maybe you have, but people say that he is a self-professed atheist. Do you know that that's actually true or not?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, it is.
So he's coming at this material. It's interesting that he wanted to do this movie in the first place. And from what I've read, this is something that he really, really wanted to do. It was... I read something and I wish I had it to back me up, but he said that after his first successful movie, which I believe was The Fountain, the next thing he pitched was Noah. He really, really wanted to do it. So there's just something about this story that really stuck with him and that he really wanted to tell it.
when he was young, and I can't remember how old, because I had this written down somewhere, but I can't find it right now. But when he was in school, high school maybe, or junior high, he wrote a paper about the dove in Noah coming back with the olive branch, and his essay was selected, and he went and read it to the UN. So he's been interested in the Noah story ever since then, or possibly, I guess, before then, since he wrote the paper. So for, what would that, 17 years, 15 years, 14 years, a long time, he has been obsessed with different versions of the flood myth, writing the story, thinking about all the characters. So it's, for him, a personal love of that story. And it really shows, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like Inception, Christopher Nolan's Inception, where he spent 10 years on the screenplay because he'd just pick it up and then put it down and work on it as he knew things came to him, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, do we need to spend any time summarizing this film before we get into spoiler territory where all the good stuff is?
I would say, yeah, for one thing, it is essentially the basic Noah story, but it's got other elements that you might not expect, which is, and a lot of them are, you know, biblically based or based on, he went into like the Jewish Midrash, which is where they'll imaginatively look at scripture and go, well, what else could we see based on what we know about scripture? What would the Nephilim be like? Which some translations call giants. And so the ways he imagined a lot of these things is very creative. And he takes it from showing when God realized the earth was corrupt and men were evil and there was one righteous man to the scene after Noah has planted a vineyard and gets drunk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yeah.
Yep. And all the animals in between. And a lot of difficult things. Yeah.
And he's filled in some places, like we see Methuselah, who probably we wouldn't have seen otherwise. So he's condensed some things and moved a few things around in the order, but not really. And what has what people did or didn't like depended on how you looked at what he added to the story, kind of linking it to personal concerns, which is there's a strong environmentalist theme, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that there's an article that I'll make sure we link to that Peter Chataway from Christianity Today, I think is who he wrote it for, wrote about all the different Genesis movies or movies that featured Noah at all from the silent movies on. And what I was really interested to see, and this kind of delves beyond describing the picture, but all of them almost have had some link to a modern concern, starting with the first silent one, which had I pulled the wrong piece of paper, which was in 1928, called Noah's Ark. It was a silent film. And it says, set during World War I, and it was produced a year before the stock market crash that kicked off the Great Depression, Noah's Ark takes aim at the modern belief in military and economic might and draws an explicit connection between the skyscrapers of our age and the Tower of Babel.
Hmm.
And then the film tells you that the flood was a deluge of water drowning in a world of lust, while the war was a deluge of blood drowning in a world of hate. So it connects it with all the wars going on. So I hadn't really realized that this story is really popular for looking at our world through its focus.
Yeah.
And so Aronofsky is the latest in that line.
Yeah. So I guess it's, God deciding that the world is wicked enough to get rid of everybody except for a few people. And then people connecting that with what they think is evil enough to be gotten rid of filmmaker. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, well, look at our age. Where are we any better?
Right. Right.
You know, so in that instance, not only are all these movies really interesting to see what people cared about, but also really interesting in order, I mean, you kind of expect the environmental thing. How will this look in 10 or 15 years when that trend or fad, as I might call it, has moved on to a different, either a different iteration or just something different altogether.
Yeah. Yeah, and you mentioned the Tower of Babel, and that's the next big story in Genesis. After Noah, mm-hmm. then directly after that, you know, several generations pass, and then you've got the Tower of Babel story.
Here we go again.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it's the, I don't know how much needs to be said beyond that. I read a lot of reviews ahead of time, knowing that I knew a lot of the story already, but there are plot twists in here that you probably don't want to know about, and that did surprise me, because I didn't read more than two or three reviews, you know, when it came out, in order to know that, oh yeah, sometime I'd like to watch it.
Right, right. Yeah, and I agree with that. I think that the main departure, if you even call it a departure, you know, is, or the main maybe source of, I don't know, thought or whatever that Aronofsky had was, you know, how would this family work? And mm-hmm. he added some twists in there. And, you know, how could these people go through this? And what would it have been like? And anyway, interesting. Definitely a lot of food for thought in this movie.
Oh my gosh, yeah, I've got 2 pages of notes and all these reviews that I marked up after, because I had a bunch of stuff I'd kept to read afterward, mm-hmm. and there's no way we could talk about all of it. But one thing I think is really fascinating is that I guess he'd read and heard so many of these stories. In many surprising ways, he stayed very true to what the people of that day would have done, in my opinion. Like, he kept the patriarchal theme of later at toward the end on the ark, when Noah wants to do something that's terrible, no one's trying to stop him, really. I mean, they're trying to stop him, but no one's saying, no, you horrible man.
Yeah, nobody's questioning his authority to do it.
You're the patriarch. You will. Yeah, exactly.
I want you to do it, but you do have the right. Yeah.
Right, mm-hmm. exactly. And so there are a few things like that, or I guess at the end, the way that it's proposed that the boys will have wives, I was like, well, yeah, that's how Klan would have handled it. But that's interesting that that's in this movie, you know, which is very modern in a few ways, like the environmental theme again.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, cool. Okay. So can we, we'll get spoilerific now.
Let's go.
Time to delve in there. Yeah, one of the first things that I noticed that I thought was really neat was early on, before things started to happen, before Noah had any kind of a vision or anything, you know, they're scrounging around looking for plants and stuff. And did you notice that you could see the stars and everything in the middle of the day?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, the light was a little bit off. You know, it was like he was saying, you know, this is a different time or whatever. And I don't think it was twilight or anything, but in the sky, there was stars. You could see the firmament or whatever. Yeah. I thought that was a really cool detail.
That is neat. I, of course, you know, you couldn't miss that strange animal that is, you know, obviously they didn't make it on the ark or they got eaten up before the ark happened. Yeah, yeah. That was kind of partly scaled. It looked like something out of a medieval tapestry or something.
Yeah, you're
that
right. You're
weird
right.
imagination. Mm-hmm. So I really liked that. And in fact, at one point on the ark, somebody's really angry and I'm like, he's off to kill the unicorns because he's pretty upset, you know.
Oh, shoot. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that is neat, though.
Yeah, so he's there doing that thing, and then a drop of water falls from the sky, and this is when he first is or notices that God is talking to him by when this drop falls on the ground and a flower sprouts up, and he's like, you know, so now he realizes something's going on.
Well, and it's a direct counterpoint to Ham picking the flower because it was pretty, and he's, you know, we only use what we need, and.
Yeah.
And it's the same flower that was picked. So it's like, I'm going to replace what's broken.
Right.
In a sense.
So, yeah. And then at the end of the same scene where introduced to the other people that are on Earth at the time, the people that live in the cities who are hunting this animal that they come across. And that's something that leapt out at me, but it is also biblical. I know some people complain about it, but the fact that Noah is a vegetarian, it is in there. Aronofsky is a vegetarian, and I felt that he was heavy-handed in several of several moments throughout the movie where, you know, it was clear that the bad guys eat this and the good guys are peaceful and don't.
Breaking God's law.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, because Noah in the Bible, this did send me partway into the movie. I grabbed the Bible and went, when those fountains are shooting up out of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what? What? And I, just being me, I happened to have a Bible back there where the TV was. And I grabbed it. And sure enough, that was it said, you know, fountains sprang up out of the deep and the flood came. Oh, shoot. I thought I marked it. But it was just, I was like, oh, I never even saw this line in the Bible before, you know.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That was such a striking visual.
Yeah. And it was. Yeah. There it is. It's Genesis chapter 7, verse 11.
Verse 11.
Yeah.
On that day, all the springs of the great deep burst forth.
Mm-hmm.
And the floodgates of heaven were opened.
Yeah, I'm looking at an NAB. It says, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, it was a Tuesday. On that day, all the fountains of the great abyss burst forth, and the floodgates of the sky were opened.
I looked this up in 4 or 5 different translations.
Uh-huh.
And they almost all spoke of it some different way. Wellsprings of the deep, the waters under the earth, which was the least evocative of anything to me. I wouldn't have noticed that ever.
Mm-hmm.
But this happened to be the one that I had back there, which was New International Version. And because it was the archaeological Bible.
Cool.
And that's as the fountains of the deep burst forth, you know, and I went, oh, it's right there.
Yeah.
How did I never see that before?
That's nice.
Yeah.
So he's got Shem and Ham with him there at the beginning. And Japheth is the third son of Noah, and he's an infant in this first part. It was interesting, and it kind of a dismal place, too.
It was terrible.
It was not a good place to live.
Well, the earth was corrupt.
Yeah, yeah.
I did look to see, because they were saying in the cities of men, you know, did whatever.
Yeah, I wrote that down because it said Cain's cities spread wickedness. So it actually started at, you know, at the beginning, you know, Adam and Eve, and then Cain and Abel, and then Cain's cities spread wickedness. You know, Cain's offspring started to build cities and things. And
And Seth was the third son, and Seth is the good line, and that's the line Noah comes from. And I was like, I didn't think about that ever. And that's the interpretation even like Saint Augustine put on. There's some confusing stuff where you don't exactly know what's going on in there, where they say, and the sons of men married the daughters of God or whatever, and a lot of, or something like that. And Augustine was like, oh, that's the daughters of the line of Seth were marrying the daughter or the sons of Cain's line. And I went, oh.
Yeah. And right. The sons of God, I think that he does that. I think the sons of God are what you're saying there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the sons of God saw how beautiful the daughters of human beings were, is what it says in the NAB. But I think Aronofsky has the same interpretation. The giants are so cool, but we need to talk about those in a minute. I was really interested too in how Noah was told what he was told. You know, it comes to him in the dreams and things. And one thing that I didn't know how I felt about was when he goes to Methuselah in order to figure out, well, what is it exactly that I need to do? You know, Methuselah gives him a drug to take. Mm-hmm. You know, when he drinks it and then he gets his vision. I don't know how I feel about that. Well, I know that I feel negatively about that. Let me just put it that way. You know, the altered consciousness method of spiritual awakening. It's something that I'm just not in tune with.
Well, and I guess I just, Methuselah was some mystic old guy in this, so I don't think I thought about that much, but I did really like the way it toward the end where Methuselah, I can't remember her name, but the Emma Watson character, Ela, is that her name?
Yeah.
Where she's barren because when she was a little girl, she was attacked and they picked her up and adopted her basically, but she can't have kids. And he doesn't use magic or one of his potions. He blesses her.
Yeah.
And the wind blows. And I was like, oh my gosh, it's the Holy Spirit. Tom gives me this look like, are you insane? And I was like, no, the Holy Spirit's often shown as a wind. That's the God. He's using the blessing.
Yeah. And you have to assume at that point, as I did, that that came from God.
Yeah.
Right? So God is the one who through Methuselah, you know, healed Emma Watson, her character. But it seemed like they didn't get that. The characters didn't get that because Noah was furious, you know, is like, what have you done? As if, you know, Methuselah had done it. And his wife kept saying, well, you know, it was my fault because I had Methuselah do it. But it didn't seem to occur to the characters that it was God who did that.
I kept waiting, and Orson Scott Card wrote about this movie, and he really liked it a lot. And I didn't agree with everything he was saying, but he said, yeah, he goes, you're sitting there just screaming at the scene. Tell them God did it. Tell them it was a blessing. Come on, you know, and which is what I was doing, because by then I was finding Noah a bit tiresome. I would say that there was the arc thing could have been trimmed a bit, I felt.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
and that's something that I spent a lot of time thinking about ever since I first saw the movie, was how, okay, clearly the director is saying that he did receive this revelation from God. Because he built an ark and animals actually came, right?
Was that not great? The
way it was really cool. Very cool.
And I noticed that the way it happens a lot, especially in the old books, you know, the story is told like three different times in a row.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's because they would always go, well, we have these three different ways of looking at it. Mm-hmm. We're not going to say one's wrong. We don't know. There are different ways of telling it. So they just put them all in.
Right. So one of them says, stories. You know, we want one pair of every animal. And another one said that we want seven.
Right.
But yeah, things like that.
You need something same to sacrifice thing as, you know, later.
The creation story is told twice as well at the very beginning.
Right. Yeah. So they'll be from different traditions maybe. But they're like, well, these probably are both right somehow. Let's not throw them out. So, and one of them says, go gather together all these animals. And the other one says, I'll send you the animals, essentially.
Yeah. And, right. Yeah.
Which I had never noticed before. Oh, that's four things I learned from this, this
nice.
Movie.
Nice. Yeah. So, so Noah has a very clear vision, you know, through Methuselah, I guess. And he's right. He's interpreting absolutely right. You know, he's doing what the Lord has said. But the Lord, you know, did not come down and say, you know, hey, I need you to build this, you know, like Bill Cosby said, right?
I think even the Bible says he said to Noah, but you don't just always know how that works.
Yeah, you don't know how that works. So then, but then he gets it wrong. He gets it so wrong when it's like he decides in his own head that, okay, what God wants is for us all to be dead. And he gets that stuck in his head. Now he's using his own thoughts and not God's, because it's clear to whoever's watching, you know, like you just said, that God blessed this. And not only that, but she had twins. And I think when she had twin girls, that was when the mom said, he sent us exactly what we needed.
It's just what you said.
Right. So now Now, she knows that it was God who did it because it was miraculous. And
well, that was but the yet
he still didn't see it. He didn't see it until the moment where, you know, well, I'm going to...
He couldn't do it.
He just couldn't do it, right.
And then that was something I thought, I loved that theme in this movie of, it's that uncertainty of how do we know it's God and how do we know when we're putting our own thoughts in there.
Exactly. And that is a huge object of contemplation that I got from this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I liked the way Peter Chataway he did two reviews. He did one right after he saw it, and then he did a second one. He watched it a second time and did another review because he said the first time he was scribbling pages of notes. He'd read the early versions of the script. He had all these things going on. He'd read interviews with everybody, and so he was thinking about all that. And he said the second time he just wanted to sit down and watch it. And so those two reviews are really interesting to read. And one of the things he says is he's talking about how powerful he found the movie. And he says, it gets everything that can be so appealing and appalling about religious faith. And I think what I like about the movie a lot is that it's not blaming you for one or the other. It's saying God can be there and talking to you and you can get it wrong. And that's, you're a human being. You still have to figure it out. And he's not slapping anyone around. And that way I felt he was not heavy-handed. It says, on the appealing side is the sense of wonder, love for creation, the conviction that right and wrong matter, the hope that God will make things right again. On the appalling side, the sense of dread, the fear of judgment, the feeling of alienation when God does not answer prayers as clearly or quickly as you would like, and the fact that the community you turn to for strength can sometimes turn against you. And then, of course, he talks about how Noah's really decent. He might be hardened because of what he's had to do to keep his family safe, but he sees himself completely as a servant of God. He's not trying to do anything for himself. He's not trying to exploit it. Says, but then his interpretations of God's will seem to go too far. And then he says, in this regard, at least, Noah becomes the sort of spiritually, psychologically, and even physically abusive parent one finds in some religious families. And his abusiveness is made all the worse by the fact that his faith is utterly sincere and not a cynical cover for a generally wretched personality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well put. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just worth a lot of thought. You know, I'm not saying that I feel negatively about that at all. I'm just saying I just keep thinking about it. You know, what does it mean for me as well?
It's that thing of you have to be like Noah in one sense and set out in faith and build that ark, even though they didn't show, you know, the way the story is often retold. You see everybody laughing at him as he's doggedly nailing it together to these precise measurements. But then you also don't ever think about the part that they showed later of what happens if you interpret it wrongly.
Yeah.
And that's, I thought that was a really
very big arc.
Well, and nothing else. And I liked and to me, I have to say, maybe the reason I did not like some of the heavy-handedness of the environmentalism, but I could really see it also as a visual explanation of that whole idea of the earth is corrupt. How do you show that?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You kind of put Mordor out there, basically.
Right. And that's kind of what it looked like, didn't it?
Yeah.
Just it was barren blasted, wasteland. Yeah.
And how could anyone even live on it? So no wonder they're having to kill animals. But then, what was I going to say, though? So, but to me, at the very end, when he's saying, be fruitful and multiply. See, I wrote this down where it was much better. Oh, the vindication to me was man's got a purpose too. The fact that God didn't want man to be gone. That's what a lot of environmentalists, the super hardcore ones, would say. We're a virus on the face of the earth, not we're a part of it. And we're doing what comes to our nature. And we just have to be more careful and wise about what we do. They would just say, man shouldn't be here at all. It should be like it was. And so the fact that he is totally on board with us as the stewards of creation vindicated the whole thing, because he was saying man has value, man has purpose, man has a reason for being, and is precious too.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, to me, was the balance.
Yeah, interesting. And I liked the expression on Noah's face at the end when he blesses the daughters, mm-hmm. and he says, multiply, you know, be fruitful.
Yeah.
And it's almost as if, you know, this is like, okay, all of history from here on, and this point, Noah's like, okay, we're going to let it happen.
Mm-hmm.
It felt like I just liked Russell Crowe's reaction, or how he played that. I thought it was very effective. Touched me deeply.
Well, and the thing that touched me, which was right before that, was his conversation with Illa. When he's like, they show him in the biblical story, Noah plants the vineyard, he gets drunk, and Ham sees him and mocks him, and then the two other sons cover him up
mm-hmm.
without looking at him. And in the story of the movie, I like that they put it in as his despair, because he had not done what God wanted. He failed God. It was his weakness that he let those babies live. And then he's talking to Illa, who says, but he gave you a choice. You were the person he chose to do this. So he left it in your hands.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, wow, what a powerful affirmation of free will.
Yeah, yeah.
And that we have the power to choose wisely, which is what Noah did.
Yep, yep, he did at the end.
Well,
yeah, when it was all said and done, he did the right stuff. He did the right thing, yeah.
And isn't that our story too?
We're not making
such monumental choices, but we all have these choices to make in how we live and how we interpret our Christian lives.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times we fail, and a lot of times we do okay.
Right, right.
You know, and we kick ourselves, hopefully not just turning into alcoholics, but we kick ourselves for the times we failed. And of course, we have help that Noah didn't have. I hadn't thought about it until I was reading some of these reviews that, you know, this is before Abraham even. This is the first covenant like uh-huh. this, the rainbow.
Yeah.
And so Noah's got no help. I mean, the first sacrifice is after he gets off the ark.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why one of the versions says take 7 pairs of every clean animal. You're going to have more of those.
Yeah.
So I thought, wow. So Noah is really treading completely new ground here.
Right. Yep. Completely and new beginning. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also have to say, I felt as unlikable as the villain Tubal Cain was, they did give you those moments of feeling for him too, where, you know, he's standing there kind of crying to the heavens, I'm made in your image too. Why will you not speak to me? Now, he gives God 2 seconds to speak, and you feel like God could have been talking to him all along and he never would have heard him.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's that anguish of, okay, I'll just do what I think is right then. And that's get everything for me, because we're men and we're made to run things.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So interesting. So Noah did have some help building the ark, though, which was very nice.
He had some rock creatures.
Yeah, weren't they cool, though? I mean,
oh, yeah.
Really terrific.
Yeah, the fallen angels who weren't, they were like another set of angels besides the Satan, Lucifer, and his gang.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, who they just wanted to help people and not make them go off on their own after the Garden of Eden. And you're like, aw.
Yeah.
And then so, when it all goes wrong, you're like, aw, God did know better than you.
Yeah, and that is there in Genesis, too. In chapter 6, verse 4, the NAB calls them Nephilim, N-E-P-H-I-L-I-M. Yeah. And then the King James Version calls them giants.
Yeah.
Those
are the two things that I've seen them called in the different.
There were giants in the earth in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah, super cool. And in the movie, they're angels, right? Well, like you said, but they're kind of trapped in, they've been imprisoned in this, in these rocks, you know, on the earth.
Yeah, so when they were flung out of heaven.
There's an angel inside animating this this rock creature, and man,
and you could see it kind of glowing through. Yeah,
I thought it was so neat.
Yeah, I loved them, and then of course I was at one point, you know, they're defending the ark, and I'm like, if they do not get to go to heaven after this, Aronofsky's the worst filmmaker ever. And of course, right then is when one of them. To heaven, I'm like, yes, okay,
yeah, baby.
But the thing I loved about them was also how they were used as a link to me between Adam and Eve and then regular man. Mm-hmm. Because Adam and Eve, in this really beautiful sequence when they're on the ark and they need to remember where they came from and where they're going, Noah tells the story of creation, and it's beautifully done. And Adam and Eve are just glowing with light. And it made me think of when Moses comes down from the mountain, you know, and he's glowing so much that people won't look at him. In fact, he has to put a veil over his face whenever he's been into the tabernacle or to the ark to talk to God, because everybody freaks out otherwise. Mm. So to me, this was, oh, yeah, you're with God all the time. You're glowing with this light of God. And, well, here we are now. Here are regular people. And I looked at it and went, oh, the Nephilim, as shown in this, are like us. The good original people are inside, but we're covered up with all this other stuff that gets in the way of showing it all the time, you know?
Oh, that's neat.
And so I really, I thought that was a great link between Noah and us and Adam and Eve. And then also the fact that, you know, when they die, they left that earthly shell behind. Now, of course, Catholic theology, the body is good and we'll be reunited with our bodies. But it's that, you know, their soul, basically, they, the essence of them, is being taken back to heaven again. Mm. So I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I like it too. Yeah. That's neat. I hadn't thought about it that way, but certainly I love it.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. So, but yeah, they helped him build the ark. Which, you know, there was a couple of things, you know, that logically are difficult in the Noah story. And one of them is, you know, how did he get that thing built? And mm-hmm. the other thing is, how did they handle all those animals? And I loved how he solved that problem. You know, as soon as the animals got on the ark, they fell asleep, went into hibernation. So they didn't have, you know, fighting between the animals and stuff to pick up everywhere.
Yeah.
They just fell asleep. Yeah. No worries about food.
I did love whatever special thing it was that all the mammals fell asleep, but the people are fine.
The people are fine. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it works. It's
maybe
magic.
It was a Methuselah thing. He said, hey, we need this stuff.
Yeah.
They'll put everybody to sleep but us.
Well, it was also, you know, they kept talking about the animals as, you know, they're the innocent ones. They're still living the way they did in the garden. And we're, you know, not so great.
Yeah. Yeah, that was another line given to Emma Watson, too. She was very wise.
Yes.
Yeah, she really was.
They needed that little girl.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what I was going to say is they find her when she's young and she's the only one left from some vicious attack. And so they pick her up and at great risk to themselves are hauling her around and healing her and everything. But Noah, I think, is the one who says she's a precious gift.
Yeah.
Oh, it's later when she says, well, I'm barren. I should leave and you should get good wives. And he goes, no, you're a precious gift to us. And I thought, you know, you don't expect in a movie where you've heard about how dark it is and how it's all looking at justice versus mercy, that there's this affirmation of, human life is very precious, even if you can't immediately see the use for it, essentially.
Yeah.
And in fact, that's echoed by Ham's story because he's trying to find a wife. He finds that girl in the bottom of the, I guess, the funeral pit or whatever it is, gets her out. And Noah, with his bad idea or twisted idea of what God really wants in the end, which is, I guess, where we all need to go. We know what we're supposed to do now, but let's not predict why God wants us to do it.
Hmm.
He leaves her behind to be trampled. And Ham's going, she was good. She was good. And I was thinking, you know, that really bothered me. And they said they put it in on purpose because there are a lot of people who were good who died. And all the animals died.
Yeah.
They said, but we also don't know anything more about her. She was good during the time he saw her down there. And I'm like, huh.
Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? Because, yeah, I mean, God killed everybody.
Yeah, it is. And that was really, you know, I've seen paintings of, and I know they had to tailor this on it, when they're, the ark is there floating nearby, and there's this huge top of a mountain that all these people are clinging to, and you could hear them in the ark screaming and wailing. And the family's going, well, we could put chains along the side. They could hold on that way. He's like, no, this is it. Just stop it. And I thought, this is so hard. They didn't show the people close up, luckily.
Yeah.
As the waves are coming up and there's less and less people left. But it's, and that story, you know, that flood happened because there's stories everywhere in every folklore and everything about the huge flood.
Mm-hmm.
China, everywhere. And when you look at the way that the Hebrews interpreted it, well, everybody interprets it that way. It depends on what the gods are doing, why they're doing it, you know. But it's worse for us because our God's a lot nicer. Okay, for one thing, he's real. But also, our God's a lot nicer than all those mythical gods that were there doing it because the people are so noisy. Mm-hmm. I don't want them around anymore. That's the Babylonian gods, I think.
The Babylonian gods destroyed the planet because we were noisy?
Is it the Babylonian ones or the Akkadian ones?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, oh, yeah. They're too noisy.
I have headphones. I can keep it down.
No, it's your talking.
Oh.
You just chatter, chatter, chatter and bother us all the time. You know? Oh, it's okay. From Gilgamesh.
Mm-hmm.
When one of the highest gods, Enlil, becomes annoyed by the cacophony of noise coming from human beings, he decides to inundate and destroy them all in a catastrophic deluge. Now, another god, Enki, the god of waters, tells their version of Noah about it. And so it says, start building a boat and load it up, you know. So they have their version too. And they say, well, the difference is there are a lot of similarities between ours and Mesopotamian accounts and that sort of thing. It says, but the difference is that our God wasn't simply irritated. He was profoundly grieved to the point that, quote, his heart was filled with pain by the magnitude of human sin. Nor was his plan thwarted by the cunning of another deity. God himself chose to preserve humanity and animal life through Noah. And it says God makes a covenant with Noah, but he doesn't grant him immortality, which is something that happens when the man is looking for. Well, it's after he gets off the ark. I think he gets eternal life for saving everybody.
Right.
And yeah. That's also part of the quest in that Gilgamesh saga.
Gilgamesh goes to find him. Yeah.
Yeah.
How are you living forever?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it says, so the difference is that can be attributed to the special revelation God gave the biblical authors, including the writer of Genesis, by which he made known his plan of redemption. So that's from the Archaeological Study Bible, which is a Protestant Bible, but it's really got some great stuff in it, by the way, about that kind of thing.
So in Genesis chapter 8, verse 21, it says, the Lord said to himself, never again will I curse the ground because of human beings, even if they don't wear headphones, since the desires of the human heart are evil from youth, nor will I ever again strike down every living being as I have done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what I love is these, when you look at these really old stories and different texts that kind of can remind you that, you know, our straight reading of something often is very superficial.
Yeah.
Without knowing how those people thought, without knowing about what are they saying about God, without more contemplation, you don't, it's easy to just go, well, yeah, see, you have an evil God. Why would he do that? And there is no answer for a lot of the disasters that happen in life, tsunamis and volcanoes. But what's interesting is what they do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Their understanding was already at that really early point so much different of how God treats people and cares for them. And I kind of really liked, I had never really thought before until I watched this movie, you know, Noah is tortured. He sees the evil. That's why he decides, oh, wait, I get it. We're all horrible. Because he's looking at that town. I think he's gone off to get wives for the boys. But then he looks at how horrible and awful everyone is. And he's like, oh, my gosh, this is the legacy of original sin.
Hmm.
We shouldn't be allowed to go on anymore. And he already is, from that point on, I think he's struggling with that. And also, what do they call it? Survivor's guilt.
Yeah, yeah.
When he's on that boat.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see it, really, when he's saying to God, really, don't tell me I don't have to do this. And the rain stops, and he goes, okay, all right, I'll do it. And everybody else standing there just goes, no, that means don't do it, don't you? You know?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's neat how Aronofsky used that part that you mentioned from chapter 9 where, you know, Noah gets drunk.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, well, you know, the reason that that happened in the movie is because he was tortured, like you said.
Yeah.
And had tremendous guilt and pain. And it's interesting. I think that Aronofsky, that was neat. Again, you know, when you talk about a midrash, that's meditation about scripture. You know, you've talked before, and I know that it's a Jesuit thing where, you know, you place yourself or you contemplate scripture by trying to put yourself somewhere where the story is happening and looking at things.
Yeah,
is that what a midrash is? Is it the same thing?
No, midrash is actually there are extra stories that are written by the rabbis or scholars or whoever.
Can any rabbi write one?
I don't know. I guess so.
Okay.
I think people would probably, considering the source and what we know about how everybody looks at stuff, they'd probably sit around and talk about it forever and ever before it got put into a book. But yeah, it's that kind of thing of filling in the gaps of what do we know that scripture tells us? And then, well, by a logical extension, what else does that mean? And so they'll tell these other little stories.
Yeah.
Kind of like Aaron and a couple people had mentioned in reviews, they were like, this is like his midrash on this story.
Yeah.
What does
yeah.
this mean for us?
Right.
And yeah, what you're talking about is kind of a similar thing in a sense of, although it's prayer, the Jesuit contemplation is like you would say, okay, I'll read the story of Noah or part of it. Now, imagine yourself there.
Yeah.
How does it feel? How does it smell? What can you hear? Are you eating anything? Okay, now you're there. What's happening around you? And it's surprising how that really helps fill in the gaps.
That's neat. Yeah, and it's interesting just to ask the question, you know, why would he plant a vineyard and get drunk, you know, after all this? And then you contemplate it and, you know, when you ask, well what would his motivation have been? Why would he have done that? It's, you know, I think it's interesting the answer that the director came up with.
Yeah, because the story demands it to go further in order to really finish it off. And I think a lot of directors would have stopped and said, now he's seen the light. The answer is love. Well, what about the guilt that you still feel for, I can't reconcile what I think God wants and what I actually did?
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
Without Emma Thompson going, you were meant to feel that love, essentially. You answered that love, and that's what God is. I mean, she doesn't say that, but I looked at it and went, right, that was God speaking in your heart. That's how he feels about you and them and everyone. To me, that was, you know, like you say, it was the look on his face for you, but to me, it was his words. It was all I could feel in my heart was love.
Mm-hmm.
And you just look at it and you go, there's the contrast between the two ways of thinking about it, there's that stern justice, but it has to always be tempered with mercy.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, well, and that was one thing I was telling you before, that because this sent me back to really read the text closely. I had read it, of course, and I've read it on my podcast and all this stuff when I read Genesis, but I hadn't thought about some of it, really.
Mm-hmm.
And so I hadn't thought about the fact, or I hadn't caught the fact, that God sends the animals, according to the text, that it isn't until after the flood that God says, and you can eat the animals, and that the fountains sprang out of the ground as well as the rain coming down, and Noah planted the first vineyard. The reason he gets drunk, according to a lot of the commentators, if he plants the first vineyard, he's the first person to really have wine. No one's gotten drunk really before.
Okay.
He had no, of course he got drunk. No one had that happen yet. And so when Ham looks at him and makes fun, and the two brothers are respectful, you understand why he wakes up and goes, "Damn it, Ham. Curses on you for being so disrespectful when I didn't know what could have happened and I was helpless and at the mercy of this thing." To me, that was suddenly, it fell into place.
Huh, okay. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. It says here, Noah, a man of the soil, was the first to plant a vineyard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was in everything. I looked in all these different things. In different ways, they all said the same thing.
Hmm.
And a couple of commenters went, yes, he never... No one had had wine before then. So I went, oh, I hear I'd been blaming him for, I'd always looked at that story as, oh, and he had feet of clay also. And it doesn't mean he didn't, but not for that reason.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I wanted to make sure to talk to you about, things like the Book of Genesis as a whole. You know, we definitely need to mention forgotten classics. And you read, what was his name? Robert Alter's yeah.
Translation. Which is really good.
So that's all out there on Forgotten Classics. And we'll certainly link to that.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And, this makes me think, the whole story of the Ark is one of those things that, I have always not known how to take. You mentioned earlier, there was a couple different ways and you said they're both somehow true and they left them in there. Use the word somehow true. Is that how you look at the whole book of Genesis? Certain things like the whole Old Testament, I guess, because there's things in the Old Testament like, the story about Job and the Jonah and the whale. I mean, are these stories to be taken literally? Are these stories to be taken as some type of a myth? Does it matter?
The thing we always have to remember is the Old Testament is a lot of different books put together, because doesn't the word Bible mean library or something like that?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so these are all different books that are from different time periods, and so a lot of them... Scholars can look at, say, the book of Job and say, oh, from the style, it was written kind of as a contemplation of this question. What about when bad things happen to good people? Where's God? Or Ecclesiastes, where it's, we die and then there's nothing. What do we think about that? How do we live? And so those are books that were... they say Jonah is like that too.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you look at where the great fish was that swallowed him and where he winds up, I remember our priest saying during a Bible study once, he's like, he'd have had to be a nuclear submarine to get there. He's like, it doesn't mean it's not true. But a lot of times things that are true aren't always factual.
Sure. Yeah.
And for the book of Genesis, I can think of it as it's telling me a truth that isn't necessarily factual, but I can also think of it as being absolutely true because it's so long ago and God's in the mix. To me, it's kind of a mystery. And then when you look at things like there are all these flood myths, does that mean there wasn't Noah? Not necessarily.
Yeah. Yeah. I've always felt about that. We've talked about that on the podcast before, the whole discovery of the Gilgamesh epic and how so many people said, see, that proves that that you guys believe a whole bunch of hogwash. When I'm like, that's incredible. Yes. You know, that's the most incredible thing. There was a flood. Holy crap.
It proves it happened.
Yeah, it's just it's just added something, you know, and that was genuinely my reaction to it when I learned about it.
Well, that's how I felt when, and I think we've mentioned this before, a few years ago, well, a few years, it could be more than that now. Mm-hmm. What is it following the female mitochondria back? Like, they're like, there's one woman who everybody's got that. And I'm like, holy moly, Eve? Hello?
You know, mitochondrial Eve. Yeah, I'm reading a Richard Dawkins book. And I'm like, well.
Yeah.
Yeah, you look at that and I'm just like, that's amazing. That is absolutely stunning. Yeah.
But the thing is that because these things are written as a story of salvation history, basically, faith, God's interaction with us, loving us personally, it's that thing also of how do you express a fact in a way that's absolutely true and people understand it? And I say, oh my gosh, Scott, it is raining cats and dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in 1,000 years, are they going to think that, you know, poodles are falling out of the sky and cats?
That's right, yeah.
Or is it, do they understand the truth of it and that there's something behind it, that it is raining a lot and this is my way of expressing it?
Yeah.
I don't demand proof for that stuff because, for one thing, I look at the really super old documents that these are and go, how do you know what people thought then? How do you know? I mean, we can guess.
Yeah.
But we also don't know what happened. And when I look at some of the miracles that you do hear about or that have happened in my own life that I know are true, how can I say these things didn't happen? But they don't have to be factually, I can write down when Eve was created for me to believe it either.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how I have that double-mindedness. Well, how do you think? Do you have problems with stuff like that?
Well, it's just one of those things that, you know, sometimes I would look at a certain thing and just go, well, how can that really be? You know, but there's always that poetical truth to things like this. Mm-hmm. But it's a constant argument in the United States, you know, amongst, you know, fundamentalists, you know, who actually say, you know, we believe this so fiercely that we don't want our kids to be taught anything different at school. And, you know, that kind of thing. And then I look at it and I say, well, as a Christian, I mean, it's certainly, you know, I have thoughts, well, like, if I don't believe that, you know, literally, you know, what does that mean? You know, does it mean that I'm not or what? You know, you have those thoughts sometimes, or I do. But at the same time, I completely understand what you're saying about the poetical truth of it. And I like the word mystery a lot because it fits in with how we as Catholics interact with it. We're comfortable with the word mystery. And we're comfortable, you know, the way that you described it, I think, just works perfectly because here this story of Noah, we seem to have evidence that something occurred. Right.
Yeah.
And if it occurred in this exact way or not is really not the point of it. This is a story and it's an object of contemplation. And like you said, you know, with that double mindedness or whatever, you know, it's not really, you know, like a logical mind and a poetical mind or whatever. You know, those things can be reconciled. And that's one of the beautiful things about the whole Catholic faith or the whole.
Yeah.
The whole world in particular, you know?
Yeah.
But it's things, you know, it comes in waves. You know, I've told you I kind of come from a Joseph Campbell background where it's just like everything's, you know, okay and everything's equally mythological. And but there's a truth to it that I've found. You know.
Well, and I struggle with that too. I mean, you know, I came from a completely secular background. I am, I think, very logical. I like proof as much as the next American, okay? Mm-hmm. And that's a lot. But I have to kind of just, and I will find myself falling into those patterns. But I kind of have to then remind myself to let it go.
Yeah.
That's not the part of me that's being called on at that point.
I would say that that exact thing, that's well put. You know, I fall into those patterns. That seems to be my fallback position. I continually am falling back into that pattern where where you start to believe, or where I do, you know, I start to believe, well, you know, everything's really, you know, what is it about this that I am practicing that makes it better in any way than what this person is doing? And is it really important? You know, I fall into those patterns all the time.
Right. Relativism.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, but the thing is that relativism, there's a difference between relativism and pluralism, where, you know, we want to live in peace with everybody.
Yes.
But it doesn't mean that everything's true. And, we are constantly every day making judgments about what's true or not. And that's okay.
Right.
We just don't have to beat everyone up. You know what I mean? That there's a thing, you know, things that are going on in the world that we need to right now say, you know what, that's evil and it's not okay.
Exactly.
We need to be able to do that. We've lost the ability in the name of pluralism turned into relativism. We want to live in peace and we want to live in peace with everybody, whatever their beliefs are. But if their beliefs are that we need to be dead, there's not really a lot of room for us to do that. And we've lost the ability to take that stand.
Yeah. And in fact, I've been looking at the whole, you know, the situation in the Middle East with ISIS and, you know, it's just miserably horrible. And I keep thinking of, you know, over the last few years, especially on Catholic blogs and places like that, and you'll look at, say, having soldiers in Afghanistan or something like that, and they'll get into this huge argument about just war, which is St. Augustine's theory that he wrote down when the barbarians were literally at the gate, you know, just wiping out one town after another in the 600s. And he was like, you know, it's okay to fight sometimes because otherwise there's nothing left. And I kept thinking at the time, I kept going, it really bothered me that just war was being applied to that situation. And I didn't really understand why, because I didn't know enough about just war and I didn't care enough, frankly, to go look at it. And I'm looking at now these towns of slaughtered, you know, with slaughtered people piled outside for no other reason than you don't believe what I believe and you won't change what you believe, which is the right to your own conscience. And I'm like, that is the definition of why you have just war. Not the war on terror. That is the definition, because those are the true barbarians and they're at the gate. And the fact that people are still squabbling over getting out there and really stopping them makes me sick. I'll just say it.
It's difficult.
Because that's Tubal Cain.
Mm-hmm.
What's to my advantage? How can I be careful about my political career?
Right.
Sorry, maybe I shouldn't have said that.
No, I mean, and that's exactly what I was referring to. You know, it becomes, in times like these, some things become really obvious. And then in daily life.
Yeah, it's harder.
it's harder because it's less important in a way. You know, you don't need to argue with everybody you come across and tell that they're wrong or something like that. But
it's not obvious.
Yeah, and at the same time, when you are making an exclusive claim. You know, when you start to take part in Catholicism, you are saying that this is what I believe, and therefore, you know, a lot of these other things are I don't believe in these other things,
right?
And so, just like I said, you know, I just continually fall back on this, and things like the Book of Genesis are things that tend to push me back into that relativism. But that's an incorrect thinking on my part. Viewing it as an object of contemplation and sometimes a mystery and almost this double-mindedness that you're talking about. The thing is that we don't fully understand. And for me to assume that I can is something that blocks me sometimes in my life. And understanding that is an important thing, but to sit here and say, well, this makes zero sense to my life at this moment, because I know pretty much everything about how things were back then. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous when you say it out loud, or when I say it out loud. You know, things were clearly different back then as described.
Well, yeah, and people, and, you know, I often will say, you know, people are the same now as they were then, and that's internally, yes, but externally in customs and culture and how people were judging different things.
Yeah.
We don't really know a lot. Right.
And
that.
Methuselah lived 900 something years, and Noah lived 300 years after the flood. So I mean, what does that mean? You know, you look at that and you're like, well, what does that mean? Were they really? I mean, what exactly does that mean? And then that, like I mentioned at the start of the movie, when the stars were in the sky, even during the daytime, I really just loved that touch because it was saying things are different right now. And, you know, I was assuming that it was something, you know, stars in the firmament, blah, blah, blah. You know, maybe earlier in Genesis, it mentions something
about
that. So, but I liked the touch, and it was a reminder that, you know, we're in a time that's not the same as today. And it was, I mean, there's all kinds of clues that something was different.
Oh yeah. But, and at the same time though, Aronofsky, I think he did such a neat job of, and neat meaning tidy and well-constructed, of connecting that really ancient time that was really different. Although I want to say costuming, I swear it looked like they were wearing blue jeans half the time. You know, it was like this kind of tidied up medieval look. And I'm like, nope, not working for me. I'm going to let it go. But no, thumbs down. But the whole idea of the way they told the creation story, the way it was visualized, when he's like, and it was night and day, and then this happened. So we're hearing the story told in those old ancient words, but we're being shown images that we know from modern science.
Mm-hmm.
Evolution, the cooling of the sun, you know, the Big Bang, all these various things are being integrated in the images of the story that we're being told in the absolute dark of that arc. And I was like, I love that he gets this, that both those things can go together.
Yeah.
You know?
You know, I'm starting to think, you know, through our conversation today that maybe, I mean, to have someone who's not attached to a religious tradition, you know, with some preconceptions, maybe he was the guy who needed to make this movie because he could not make those statements. He made the environmental and vegan statements, but the rest of it, he just stuck right to it.
Yeah, and they were heavy-handed, the environmental and, you know, eating animals and stuff. But, you know, you can justify somewhat the eating animals thing just based on the idea that up until that point, as the Bible tells us, you weren't supposed to do that. So you can get away with that. The environmental thing, we are supposed to be stewards of creation. It was a heavy overlay. I allowed it. I'm in sympathy with a lot of that stuff. Not to the point of excluding people, though. And that's, I think, why I really resonated to that idea of be fruitful and multiply. You know, we are here to take care of things. Because that is a Catholic understanding of that now. And may have been for a long time, for all I know.
Yeah.
But I think what we forget when we try to just, I think maybe the service that this movie does is it looks at where's the humanity and where's God? How do we relate to him? How do we live it in our lives? Because that's what Noah's struggling with. He's given a bigger thing to live with than most of us, but he is the only righteous one left. He's the only, and righteous means you're in harmony with God. You know, that's Joseph. Jesus's stepfather was a righteous man. That's why he would have those dreams and he would wake up and instead of going, I wonder if that was true, he knew they were true. He got up and went, Mary, get the kid ready. We're going to Egypt, you know, right now.
Yeah.
So if that was Noah, then we put ourselves in that place too. The Bible is a record not only of what has God done for us and what has our history been, but it's still, it's alive today. It's, we look at that story, we are Noah. Are we, you know, trying to listen? And I think that's what this movie tells us. You know, it's, and it's, I loved the thing, and it was used in the trailer when Illa says, what will it be like, the end of everything? And he says, the beginning. The beginning of everything. And how often have we looked at things and said, this is the worst absolute thing ever. And it is horrible. It's somebody who's died. It's a horrible accident. It's, we've lost our job and we have nothing. It's whatever. But can it turn into the beginning of everything? We can't see it. And it can. That's what God can do.
Yeah.
If we work with him.
Right. Well put.
Oh, thank you.
I like it. It, you know, and this movie does, you know, give us those thoughts, and it's a good thing.
Yeah, it's kind of a reminder to me of even these really old books that don't seem to say anything to us. You know, this is a dramatic story, but I'm reading through Judges right now, very slowly. Talk about a bloody book that's pretty much showing how many ways you can do it wrong over and over and over. And here, God had to bring us another hero, because boy, did we screw it up this time. And it's even just reading those little stories, if you just read a little bit and you kind of sit and say, is there something for me in here? You know, God, there a word for me in here? Sometimes there isn't. But sometimes surprising things come out of it. And maybe they're small things, but they're things that kind of connect you to those people or make you think about your own life. Because there, it's all... what is that? Everybody has said this, you know, but it's God's love letter to us. Sometimes the people you love tell you things you don't want to hear.
Yeah, yeah.
But you need to hear it.
That's true. That is true.
I wouldn't have thought this movie, this director would have given you such a good look at original sin and God's grace.
Hmm.
But I think he did a good job of it, really.
I think so, too. I think he did. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't mention the fact that I liked it more the first time I saw it than the second time I saw it.
Hmm.
And I'm right now trying to decide why that was.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
Was it because you were watching it to talk about it versus watching it just as an entertainment?
Very, very possibly, yeah. You think? Yeah, very possibly.
Huh.
Yeah, but the first time I watched it, when I came away, I was like, wow, that was really something, you know, from a religious standpoint. Yeah, I don't know.
So what made you not, was there one thing, or was it just a lot of stuff that you just didn't like as much this time?
Well, I think that there was, I don't know, I can't even put my finger on it. I was annoyed by the environmentalist stuff. Which, you know, I normally don't mind it, just like I felt it was heavy-handed, kind of clumsy, you know, which is interesting. You know, we've talked about in religious movies made by religious people, often they just are hitting you over the head with something. And that's one of the things that he really didn't do in this. I thought that he pulled off all of the religious stuff very, you know, very well and left you with, again, you know, things to contemplate. Without being annoyed.
Well, it was the secular religious stuff, essentially.
Uh-huh. Right.
You know, the environmentalism.
Yeah, and that did turn me off.
That you're talking about. Yeah. Right. And it's funny because thinking about that and thinking about our conversation about Pavan, where I was really having to fight through every time I'd kind of get back to the book and he'd come up with, oh, and the Catholic Church, how awful they are. And you said that didn't bother you.
Yeah,
because it wasn't your church, you know, that you knew.
Sure.
And it bothered me because I was like, yeah, that's why it bothers me. It's the church I know. Talk about it right.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I, what was it that I was reading recently where it was a similar thing? Oh, just this trilogy where, you know, you reread something and all the elements I liked are still there, but I hadn't read it for years and years. And suddenly I was like, does it have to be every page? Here's why I can't believe in God. Here's why all these people who believe in God are stupid. And I'm like, I've read this since I've become Christian. Why did this suddenly, now I can't stand it anymore?
Hmm.
I think you just, different points of your life, you can't tell where you are, where that stuff's going to getcha.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I think you're right.
Because I could take it for the first two books, but then the third one came on really heavy-handed, and I'm like, first two, I was like, okay, that's fine.
It's like, no thanks, yep.
Yeah. But then they just
certainly have felt that, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Well, cool. Well, all right, well, we better wrap this beauty up.
Oh my gosh, this is a beast.
Thanks for staying with us, everybody.
Yeah, anybody who's left, we appreciate it.
All right. I'm just looking up here. What do we have
coming up? And we've got a big list of stuff. We've been really putting, choosing books and movies and things.
That's right. We're scheduled out there for a while.
Yeah, we are. Okay,
so we've got Ashes to Ashes by Emma Lathan next. And again, I do have a copy of that. Found it on Paperback Swap. So looking forward to that.
Yep.
And then after that, we're going to do The Life of Brian. Monty Python's Life of Brian. Oh, makes me laugh.
Oh, Life of Brian.
And then it's October.
Yes.
Yes, and we're going to talk about Salem's Lot, one of my favorite books of all time, by Stephen King. And then a movie that I love very much called Super 8.
Is that Spielberg?
I think it's Spielberg and Abrams. I think Abrams is the director.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Spielberg produced, I believe.
Just had a feel of Spielberg, but when you said Abrams, I'm like, right, J.J. Mm-hmm. Abrams.
Okay, right,
got
right.
it. Yeah.
And then after that, we're going to do a religious book, and you've chosen The Catholic Church Through the Ages, A History by John Vindmar. And I did receive that this week, so I've got my copy.
Yeah, that is, I've had mine and I've started looking through it because it's, 300 or 400 pages or whatever, but it's history, so I wanted to read it kind of carefully. It's interesting because it's a good overview.
Yeah, cool.
And it seems to tell you enough about all the big issues, and, but so then you can say, like, you know, we've been talking about the Reformation a lot lately, so then you can go, oh, okay, here's this understanding of the Reformation. Here's some good reference books, or I'll go dive in deeper.
Nice. That's great.
But I felt like we've been talking about history so much, I really was wanting to read a history of some sort.
Yeah, and I think that's great. It fits perfectly into what I would like, too. And
okay, good.
In fact, I just yesterday got received A Popular History of the Reformation by Philip Hughes, which is a book that was recommended to me by someone here in town at church that I was talking to. It's a paperback. So it arrived yesterday, and it's in good shape. It's out of print, I'm pretty sure, but this paperback is kind of an older one.
57. His stuff, though, has pretty good reviews. I mean, it's older history, but as long as you don't want anything from Vatican II on.
Uh-huh.
I looked through, there was a copy of the three, he did a more in-depth church history.
Mm-hmm.
And three of the early books were put together on the Kindle for 99 cents. So I went, well, let me just try it because my library doesn't have any of his stuff. And I was really liking it. So.
Good. Great.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So we'll be steeped in history.
Yeah.
I felt like I didn't know enough. These last two episodes, we were like, or I was, you know, kind of floundering around going, well, I think this is what happened. This is my understanding.
But again,
it's opened a door. It's opened a door, and let's walk through it.
Well, we should know more about it, and I think it's easy to forget unless it's a period that you really care about. So it's good to revisit it, I think, for me.
Yeah.
Every so often, I forget things very easily. So.
Mm, sure.
Yeah, so lots of good reading and movies out there.
Heck yeah. You bet.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody. See you in a couple of weeks.
Yep. Thanks a lot. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.